This is Kyle Williams, The Unconscious in Historical Perspective, October 10th, 2008. This was recorded on DVD. The DVD is available in the office of the Jung Society.
Good evening, everybody. My name is John Buescher, and I'm the promotions chair for the Jung Society. And it is my pleasure to introduce tonight Kyle Williams. She's been a student of analytical psychology for 20 years. She has taught comparative religion at Hunter College in Marymount, right, in New York, the University of Manitoba in Winnipeg, and Antioch University in Seattle. Her poetry, scholarly essays have been published in Lepi's magazine, Psychological Perspectives, and elsewhere. She divides her practice as a psychotherapist between Seattle and Princeton, British Columbia. Please help me in welcoming Kyle to the stage.
Well, this is an essay that was written in 1947. It's one of Jung's few attempts at really encapsulating everything, which he really hated doing and which was really fairly impossible to do. But as a result of that kind of an attempt, what you end up with is an incredibly dense essay. And the first section of this essay is called The Unconscious in Historical Perspective. It runs for about 7 pages, the very first section of this. And I've pulled out about 10 major points that I want to underscore in reading this essay with you. And again, if you are moved at any time to ask a question or participate, I want to keep this really open for discussion. And it's also, I think, beneficial for everybody when spontaneous thoughts arise. And if you feel like jumping in, please feel free to do so. So the first point I want to make: what does he mean when he says the unconscious in historical perspective? In other words, what is the history of this idea of the unconscious? And how does the unconscious play itself out in history? So right from the get-go, we've got this sort of problematic idea. First of all, the history of the idea of the unconscious, and how does the unconscious, how does it manifest in history? How does it show itself? And by defining the first question, you actually get kind of an answer to the second question as well. So what does he mean when he says the unconscious in historical perspective? Well, first thing he says is this: more clearly perhaps than any other science, psychology demonstrates the spiritual transition from the classical age to the modern. The history of psychology up to the 17th century consists essentially in the enumeration of doctrines concerning the soul. But the soul was never able to get a word in as the object investigated. So I just want to stop right there. So right there in that very first sentence, he tells you what he's going to talk about. The history of psychology is the history of the soul. And yet, the history of the soul is also encapsulated in all the great religions of the world, and also in the history of philosophy. Philosophers, up until about the 16th century, loved talking about the soul, right? That was where it was at. Descartes, all the philosophers had major problems with the church as they went along. They wanted to talk about the soul, where it was, what it was, how it functioned. But the soul was also sort of the domain of the church. So how do you say what you want to say as a philosopher and also sort of struggle with this kind of power domination that the church has, this kind of monopoly, if you will, on what the soul is and where it is? So, and then psychology comes along and starts to break down the functionality of philosophy itself. So Jung says, in the course of philosophy, nobody's ever really, we've talked a lot, lots of philosophers have talked about what they think the soul is, how it functions, where it is, what it is, but nobody's ever asked the soul itself. It's pretty startling. I don't think it's an easy question. The question is, what do we really mean by soul or psyche? Anybody want to take a shot at it? I don't think there are any wrong answers. He means something more than the mind, and yet he also says exactly what you quoted. He says, as the immediate datum of experience, it seemed so complete to know, completely known. It seemed so completely known. So he defines it right there in the next sentence, the immediate datum of experience. So this body of data known as experience. In other words, there's a certain kind of individuality about soul. And it has a little something to do with my experience and your experience and the composite of a lifetime's worth of experiences. It has a little something to do with inner versus outer. There's something inclusive about soul. It includes mystery. It includes something that's unknown, perhaps. Now, the church is going to define it, philosophy is going to define it as really kind of the commodity of immortality, right? When the church talks about soul, they talk about it as, what do we want? We want your immortal soul. Our job as the Catholic Church, which is, of course, where a lot of Western philosophy comes out of, medieval philosophy, Western philosophy, comes out of the idea that you're a soul, and you're a soul, and you're a soul. So you are soul, and you have soul. You are something, and you experience something. You contain something, but it's also something that's both beyond you and something that you both shape and affect and participate in and with and through. And it's something that outlasts you, right? It's what's left over when you're gone that the church tries to sort of bargain for, right? They're out to save your soul. And somehow you are separate from your soul as well, right? If you are sort of the human, I mean, the church basically has that essential division, right? Spirit. Division in traditional Catholic theology or traditional Christian theology, it's spirit and matter. But of course, this is what? Not so great, questionable, demeaned. This is the body and the feminine and all of that. And spirit gets what we aspire to, right? So for centuries, we degrade all of this, and we elevate all of this. And soul has something to do with moving from one to the other. So there's the question of what is soul is a huge question. It's a huge question. And I think it changes from philosopher to philosopher, from theologian to theologian, from religion to religion, and definitely from psychologist to psychologist. And that's one of the things that makes Jung's work so unbelievably groundbreaking, is he says, somebody should ask the soul to define, what are you? What are you? Tell us what you are. And if we have direct experience of that, that is the objective voice of the psyche. So he says the attitude, this attitude to give the soul its own voice, to give it some sense of objectivity rather than just I experience or I think I know, to give it some sense of its own voice, this attitude is really totally alien to the modern standpoint. For today, we are of the opinion that over and above all subjective certainty, I know that when I die, I will go to heaven, that kind of theology, that kind of certainty, right? the kind of certainty. Picture the Catholic theologians preaching that kind of certainty. Over and above all subjective certainty, objective experience is needed to substantiate an opinion that lays claim to be scientific. So if somebody was going to ask, what is DNA? How is that a different question than what is the soul? Well, first of all, it's on this side of the equation, right? It can be looked at. It can be measured. We have something that we call objective datum about it. We can break it down into its smallest components, and we can say, it's not just what I say DNA is. It's not just my subjective experience of my own DNA. It's what I can see and prove and measure and show and predict. It's something objectifiable. It's shown me what it is independently of my view or my experience of it. And that's what Jung is saying is called for when we start to define what's the soul. Asking the soul to give its own voice. What do you think of that? Impossible. Barbara says impossible. Is it? No, she takes it all back. Well, why does it seem impossible? Yeah, Lynn? The still small voice within. Yeah. Well, and that's really the argument that he's going to make, is that that there is, in fact, an objective scientific methodology for encountering the soul on its own terms and listening and allowing the soul to speak for itself. And that, of course, is the contents of dreams and the contents of the psyche as it shows itself both through dreams and in experience. But it starts to get murky. It starts to get murky. So let's go on and see what he says about how we're going to separate some of this out here. So he says, it's still difficult, even today, for those of you who are looking, I'm at the top of, in my pagination, it's page 70, which is the first part of paragraph 343. It is still difficult, even today, to apply the purely empirical or phenomenological standpoint consistently in psychology, because the original naive idea that the soul, being the immediate datum of experience, was the best known of all knowables, is one of our most deeply rooted convictions. So in other words, let me just go on. Not only does every layman presume to have an opinion, but every psychologist too. This is where he starts his digs. And not merely with reference to the subject, but what is of greater consequence, with reference to the object. He knows, the psychologist, or rather he thinks he knows, what is going on in another individual. Now there's a lot of audacity in this, to stand up and start to criticize other psychologists for not knowing what they're doing, for claiming that they know, and claiming maybe they don't know as well as they think they know, but what they think they know is probably something more about themselves than it is about the person that they're in charge of treating, of healing. So he's calling into question the whole history of psychology so far. He knows, or rather he thinks he knows, what is going on in another individual and what is good for him. This is due less to a sovereign disregard of differences than to a tacit assumption that all individuals are alike. As a result, people incline unconsciously to a belief in the universal validity of subjective opinions. I'm experiencing something. I see something a certain way. It's very clear to me. Why don't you see it that way? Aren't you the same as I am? Aren't we in the same room and reading the same text? And right? So that the whole culture operates with this tacit assumption that we're all in agreement about this. We're all having a similar experience. When psychologists get together in a room, we have the DSM-4, and we can all say, oh, well, that man is clearly schizophrenic, right? He exhibits this, that, and the other. We assume something about his personality, and then we assume that we know better, and we assume that he's sick and we're not, right? And Jung says, wait a minute, be careful. Be very, very careful when you start to make these kinds of presumptions. First of all, that everybody's the same. And second of all, that you may actually know what it is that separates you, because you may not, because it may all be the datum of experience. It may all be a question of undifferentiation of soul. Now I know I've lost you. But let's go on to the next paragraph. I think he makes it a little clearer. It never occurred to the representatives of the old view, and he's talking here about philosophers mostly, that their doctrines were nothing but psychic phenomenon. For it was naively assumed that with the help of intelligence or reason, man could, as it were, climb out of his psychic condition and remove himself to one that was suprapsychic and rational. So in other words, the more rational I get, the more reasonable I get, the more intellectual I get, the more up here I become. And so therefore, the more correct my perspective. And if you couple that with the authority of theology or the authority of academic philosophy, you start to get a feel for what he's talking about. He's trying to kind of bring down these established hierarchies, these established modes of operation, right? Theology, philosophy. He wants to say, you guys think you know how the world works with all your ivory tower philosophy and highly reasoned, you know, intricate philosophies, but really your version is just one more expression of soul that happens to fit you. It may not really fit me at all. It may not fit the schizophrenic at all. It doesn't account for some of the things that he may experience. And it, of course, you know, divides. Makes one of us crazy and one of us genius. But I think the point he's also making here is, can we ever climb out of this? Are you with me? That we're all in this kind of soup? He loved American expressions, and I have one in my kitchen, actually, that says something like, we're all in the soup that's going to be cooked for us. We're all in the soup. Edinger had a similar analogy. He used to talk about the fish in the fishbowl as an image of psyche. If we're always in it, how do we know when we're ever out of it? And are we ever out of it? If the bottom line is psyche, and all of culture is manifestation of psyche, right? Politics, sociology, education, theology, religion, when all of these sort of social movements, academic disciplines, and so on, are all subject to soul, and they are. How can they not be? How can they not be when they're made up of individuals who have these experiences? We look at our politicians. They're great guys, most of them, some of them. But they are individuals with very particular kinds of experiences carrying around the archetypal world for the rest of us. So the question of, can we ever get separated from this? Can we ever climb out of it? It's unnerving. Even now, the doubt as to whether the statements of the human mind might not in the end be symptoms of certain psychic conditions is one that few people would consider seriously. What do you mean there aren't these distinctions? What do you mean it's all soul? Of course there are these distinctions. There's philosophy, there's theology, there's politics, there's this, there's that. They're all valid, they're all independent. What do you mean they're all sort of creations of soul? It becomes very amorphous and very without separation. So that is unnerving and very difficult to swallow for most people, because people depend on those distinctions. We depend on those dividing lines, and that those things are all quite real and separate. Not that they're all manifestations of psyche in some way. I think, where does the individual fit into it? The individual is it. I think the individual is all of it. But then when you start to step back and make theories about it, or make a school of thought and call it psychology, and start to theorize about what individuals are, I think that's exactly Jung's point, is that the basic element is so unique and so individual that you can't make these big claims. And yet, he's going to turn around and do that. He's going to turn around and do that. And say, actually, the more specific you get to the individual, the more subjective you get, the more objective you become. What? It's intensely paradoxical. Intensely paradoxical and confusing. Would you have a sense of what I'm talking about? Barbara's nodding like she knows sort of what I'm talking about. Yes, I've heard this before. So the lines between subjectivity and objectivity get very blurry, very blurry. And the whole notion of what truth is, what validity is, goes right up in smoke, right? Because if I say that all of theology and all of philosophy is just a bunch of individual guys coming up with their own little individual truths, then what's true anymore? So truth itself becomes completely simplified. How can you run a culture on relativized truth? The criminal runs around saying, oh, well, it's my truth, man, you know. You can't do that. Law, so on, depend on sort of organized agreements of, you know, right, wrong, that sort of thing. John? Yes. Exactly. And it depends on that notion of empiricism. Because, in other words, the deeper an individual goes into the subjective truth, the closer, paradoxically, he or she gets to the shared truth of the patterns of experience. Right? If you look at 300,000 dreams in hundreds and hundreds of individuals the way Jung did, you get to start seeing patterns as well. Doesn't mean that one thing means the same thing to every single person, but when you start to define the patterns of the contents, you start to see things fit into certain kinds of categories here. And the question becomes, truth is truth no longer with a capital T. It's just a small t truth. But the more you drill down into the individual and the individual psyche, the individual can start to say, my truth. That flies in the face of a lot of things. But it means that you no longer, and this is the lonely part, it means that you no longer get to participate in this. Because you can't anymore. To thine own self be true. To thine own soul be true. The bottom of paragraph 344. Not even the psychologist is prepared to regard his statements, at least in part, as a subjectively conditioned confession. You see, experts don't talk this way. They don't say, well, my opinion is, my experience is, you know, we talk this way more and more in the sort of New Age world. You know, well, my experience of it is this. Now they say, no, look, this is what's going on out there. This is what we have to do. It's an evil empire. It's this, it's that. We have to name it and collectively agree upon what it is and what we call it and what kind of action we take. Subjective experience isn't enough. We have to pool subjective experience and come up with a sort of extroverted plan on how to deal with things. And he's saying psychologists act in the same manner. And we do this when we treat our patients. And that's not right. It's dangerous. It's extremely dangerous. A friend of mine, nowadays when you learn psychology, it's imperative that you study the DSM-4. If you want to get your psychotherapy paid for by insurance, you have to have a diagnosis. My friends, whether you face this or not, I don't know. You have to be categorized with something that your insurance will pay for, which usually isn't just things like marital difficulties or, you know, all the things that everyone has, right? Yeah, you have to be categorized. You have to be named with something like this. And in that sense, the training behind psychology now really is a training that's based upon this capital T truth. I know for you what you are and what, you know, and how best you should be treated. The empirical model is terrifying because it's so amorphous and so unable to be distinguished. Because how do I learn it? How do I learn to apply this? There is no this to apply anymore. You follow me? There's no model that I can apply straight across the board. But really, if you... one psychologist, a friend of mine, said it quite well. He said the DSM-4 is like the new Malus Maleficarum. You guys familiar with that book that the Catholic Church wrote a book in the, I think it was the 13th century, called the Malus Maleficarum, the Hammer of Witches. It was basically a manual so you could tell who was a witch and who wasn't. So, sort of like what? Sort of like being a liberal, that's right. You speak up, you're unpatriotic, so be careful. He says, we can say that individuals are equal only insofar as they are in large measure unconscious. Unconscious, that is, of their actual differences. The more unconscious a man is, the more he will conform to the general canon of psychic behavior. This. Right? The more contained he is in those distinctions that we make. The more conscious he becomes of his individuality, the more pronounced will be his difference from other subjects, and the less he will come up to common expectations. Further, his reactions are much less predictable. This is due to the fact that an individual consciousness is always more highly differentiated and more extensive. But the more extensive it becomes, the more differences it will perceive, and the more it will emancipate itself from the collective rules. For the empirical freedom of the will grows in proportion to the extension of consciousness. As the individual differentiation of consciousness proceeds, the objective validity of its views decreases and their subjectivity increases. Just what we've been talking about. You with me so far? So true and valid describe what the majority believe, for this confirms the equality of all, but a differentiated consciousness no longer takes it for granted that one's own preconceptions are applicable to others and vice versa. So why philosophy fails? It gradually became clear that no philosophy had sufficient general validity to be uniformly fair to the diversity of individual subjects. It naturally became necessary to abandon philosophical argument and replace it by experience. So remember, it's 1947, World War II, the great catastrophes just happened. Reason, the German society, which was literally the best of all possible thinking, the best in medicine, the best in philosophy, the best in theology, the highest sciences, all of that located in German thinking, German speakers, German writers. America was not the pinnacle of thought at that point in time. Germany was it. If you wanted to be a scholar, that's where you went at the turn of the century. That's where you went. And all of that high reason had just blown up. And we had just seen that reason can't take us there. In fact, reason, you know, because reason goes up here for the most part. Reason had failed dramatically. So something has to be shifted. And empiricism and investigation into experience is what he's advocating here. And then he says, in most universities, even if you study psychology, anybody study psychology? Did you study, when you studied psychology, was it behaviorism mostly in academia? Cognitive behavioral now, yeah, so that's pretty much what it is now. I mean, there's, you know, you mentioned the unconscious in a department of psychology, and you put your academic career on the line if you make it that far. In fact, there's only one department of psychology in all of North America that is devoted to analytical psychology, and that's a very small little corner of the psychology department at Texas A&M University. So now this is not true for the rest of the world. Europe, you can find it quite a bit, but they're ahead of us on this. Japan, you can find it, but North America, afraid not. So the overvaluing of rationality isn't working, and he's again just calling into question the fact that psychology, of all the academic disciplines, he says, has been the least able to win its independence from all of this. So let's take a little bit of a break, and okay, so we'll get started again. So one of the biggest villains in this little first introductory section of this essay, you know, like any scholar, Jung is going to pull out people to argue with. Those are his villains, people he doesn't like. He's going to call them to task and argue with them and disagree with them. And then he's going to pull out people from the history of psychology that he does like who validate the points that he's trying to make. And one of the biggest villains in the first part of this essay, the people that he wants to argue with, is Herbert. Wundt, Wilhelm Wundt. And he wants to kind of attack the history of psychology and find out why it is that they've degraded and even denied the existence of the unconscious. And this, to him, is the history of the unconscious perspective. And he says that the fact that psychology as a discipline, the fact that it's been unable to extricate itself from this total dependence on the rational and the total denial of the non-rational or the unconscious, he says, this backwardness to me seems significant. You know, why? When psychology is the study of the soul, supposedly, mind, etc., the position of psychology is comparable with that of a psychic function which is inhibited by the conscious mind. Okay, the position of psychology itself is comparable with that of a psychic function which is inhibited by the conscious mind. It's in there, it just can't come forward, right? Something is stopping it. He says psychology itself is acting this way. Only such components of it are admitted to exist as accord with the prevailing trend of consciousness. And here's the clincher. Whatever fails to accord is actually denied existence. In defiance of the fact that there are numerous phenomena or symptoms to prove the contrary. You with me on that? It's pretty profound. Let me read it again. Whatever fails to accord is actually denied existence. We don't like it, it's inconvenient, it's uncomfortable. I've got all kinds of things that I can consciously state that prove otherwise. Therefore, it's a threat. It's denied. It's pushed out, right? And he actually uses the word, the splitting off of the inconvenience, right? It's inconvenient to deal with this stuff because it's not easily grasped. And it's not easily defined. It's a big, well, I had a client, actually, who put it really well. This is a man with a very intense history of some really hard, hard stuff. And he said, sometimes I think to myself that I'm floating in an inner tube in the middle of the ocean like a little hors d'oeuvre. And I feel something swim against my leg, and I know how deep it is underneath me. That's not denial. That's not denial. But you can see why people would want to brush that off. In other words, if the unconscious, you know, the ocean, the great symbol of the unconscious, right? The abyss, the depths. If we acknowledge that that's working in our lives every single day, that that's running our politics, that that's running our law enforcement, that that's teaching our kids in our schools, that that presence is out there, the reality of the non-rational, the reality of the unconscious, if we really start to accept that, it gets a little nerve-wracking. So it's much easier to say, oh, the unconscious doesn't exist, we're not going to teach it in academic psychology, we're just going to sort of leave it. Because we can't prove it, we don't know what it is, and yet it's such a palpable part of ordinary people's experience that the fellow I just told you about can give you the perfect analogy of what that really feels like when you're up against it. Yeah. Yeah, and then we all turn into preachers, right? And then we want it to be because we think it's important to know that the beast is in the water. Because if you feed him a little, he won't swim up and attack you. Or maybe if you pay a little bit of attention, and of course that's Jung's point about the shadow, which of course you all know. You know, the more we sort of make room for it, the more we acknowledge it and try to get to know it, you know, you have to negotiate with your enemies. It's not rocket science, but it's very terrifying to take that leap. And for some people, it's just not a necessity. And I think that's where eventually you have to just say, maybe they're not called. Maybe they're not called. I do think with most people it's true. But I also, so it's their truth. And I think that... But generally, you can also say, and this gets a little pejorative, you can say they're stuck in this. They're stuck in this collective that agrees upon the denial of it, the unconscious denial of it. It's not that they say, oh, we know about it and we're going to deny it. No, it's just, it doesn't exist for me. But it does exist, and you can, of course, find areas in her life. Anybody who suffers meets it, and most people, unfortunately, suffer. Exactly.
So
exactly.
We do get even if we try to ignore it.
Well, I would probably say yes, but then that's my sort of.
Well, you would know because you're seeing more cases than, for
example,
myself.
Yeah.
You would say that
holds
up.
Swims up and bites you on the behind? I think that's how that goes. Something like that, yeah. But he's fascinated with the fact that psychology itself is literally split off from the notion of regarding the unconscious or taking the unconscious seriously. And, well, he goes on and on sort of arguing with Wundt. But what he's particularly amazed, he quotes him and he says, this is Wundt speaking, "Assumptions as to the state of the unconscious or as to unconscious processes of any kind are," and Jung emphasizes in italics, "entirely unproductive for psychology. There are, of course, physical concomitants of the psychical dispositions mentioned, of which some can be directly demonstrated, some inferred from various experiences, etc." So in other words, he's saying that the history of psychology at the turn of the 19th century into the 20th century is really hell-bent on preserving this rationalism and staying really with what they can measure. Well, I think it has to do with science's prevailing attitude that that a lot of that stuff is just hogwash and mystical bunk and spiritualism. You can't go near it because you can't measure it, and it tends to be the stuff of unpredictability and airy-fairy. And what's interesting is in our day and age, these get flipped, right? In the scientific model, matter and rationalism literally become much higher valued. I mean, this is our prevailing mythology now, right? And spirit becomes... Well, we just don't quite know what to do with it. Yeah.
One thing is that at the turn of the century, they were to distance themselves from that
Absolutely.
Aspect of
absolutely. And because of the decay of the projection that had been holding, the collective projection onto organized religion that had held for all of the past, you know, millennia, really, 2,000 years, had started to fade. I mean, Victorian England, the church does not have the same hold that it does in medieval Europe, right? Things are starting to change. Technology is happening. The Enlightenment happened. Rationalism had become the key to the individual's, the progress of culture and the individual's own, movement upward out of the depths, out of darkness and poverty and so on. Education was more valued. Things like that start to happen. So, yeah, the projection onto religion starts to fade away. And what happens when it starts to break down? It goes into its opposite. And you start to get these kinds of movements. Magicians, you think of, who's that famous magician? Houdini, those kinds of shows and theaters are very popular during that time. And Madame Blavatsky goes off to Tibet and comes back with a few good hat tricks. Yeah, exactly. Okay, so let's see. But what's interesting, so he calls to task these thinkers in psychology, and then he says, a representative of the Wundt school opines that, quote, a psychic state cannot be described as psychic unless it has reached at least the threshold of consciousness. This argument assumes, or rather asserts, that only the conscious is psychic. Again, what do we mean by psychic? And that therefore everything psychic is conscious. The author happens to say a psychic state. Logically, he should have said a state, for whether such a state is psychic is precisely the point at issue. What? But that's exactly our current problem with psychology, too, that only the conscious is psychic. If I'm a psychologist and you come to me with a problem, I'm going to talk to you about everything you already know about. Everything conscious in your life already. Now, this was Marie-Louise von Franz's argument against associating to dreams. She said, if I get associations about a dream, that's stuff that the patient already knows about. Oh, this reminds me of that, this reminds me of that. That's all conscious. That's not the unconscious meaning of the dream. That may be connecting and helping you connect and helping the unconscious part emerge. But anybody who's ever sat with an analyst to work on a dream knows that, yes, you can go on consciously about this, that, or the other thing, a particular image or whatnot, but it's not until that something bubbles up from nowhere and you say, oh, wait a minute, I think I have an idea here. Or the analyst helps you to do that. So do you see what he's getting at? He's saying you can't just call psychology the stuff of consciousness. It leaves out, really, almost everything. So then he starts to, and he quotes Herbert. He says, when a representation or idea falls below the threshold of consciousness, it goes on living in a latent way. See, he likes this because this is what he's building his own work on. It goes on living in a latent way, continually striving to recross the threshold and to displace the other representations. Now, he wants to argue a little bit with him, and he says, as it stands, this proposition is undoubtedly incorrect, for unfortunately, anything genuinely forgotten has no tendency to recross the threshold. Had Herbert said complex in the modern sense of the word instead of representation, his proposition would have been absolutely right. We shall hardly be wrong in assuming that he really did mean something of the sort. In this connection, a philosophical opponent of the unconscious makes the very illuminating remark, "Once this be admitted, one finds oneself at the mercy of all manner of hypotheses concerning this unconscious life. Hypotheses which cannot be controlled by any observation." Okay, so now you feel what he's talking about. If we let this in, nothing else is safe. If we let in this idea that the unconscious is a reality, then all bets are off. We can't make any more distinctions because suddenly everything becomes subjective. Everything becomes on very shaky ground. Can't be measured. Then he says it can't be controlled by any observation. One finds oneself at the mercy. Those are feeling words to me. In other words, it's a sense of giving the power away. One finds oneself at the mercy of all manner of hypotheses concerning. In other words, they can say anything. If we let them say that the unconscious exists, then they can say anything. We can't control any of these hypotheses anymore. And then Jung says, it is evident that this thinker is not out to recognize facts, but that for him the fear of running into difficulties is decisive. And how does he know that these hypotheses cannot be controlled by observation? For him, this is simply an a priori. Before knowing, he's decided. And that's what I think Jung eventually is saying. How do you know it can't be controlled? Unless, if you don't do your empirical experiment, if you don't do your experiment with your own soul, how do you know? If you don't negotiate with the enemy, if you don't reach out to the beast, how do you know? You know, in the classic fairy tale, it's the beast that guards the treasure. It's the redemption of the darkness where the treasures lie. And it's going through that for anybody who's been through an analysis. That's the payoff. That's the payoff for the terror of confronting the dreams. So, let's see. So then he spends the rest of the essay really trying to make certain connections between these different thinkers and various ideas, both of his own and finding his own ideas in other people's work. For example, this is paragraph 352 in about the middle. Again, he's criticizing Wundt. He says he obviously boggles at an unconscious representation being one which nobody has. An unconscious representation, what is it? You can't have it, you don't know what it is, it's different from person to person, and yet we're claiming that there's something that connects them, something that similarly, that we can find similarities between them that we can actually start to connect, and Jung wants to then make a theory or hang a notion on it. So he says, we can easily get around all of this difficulty by speaking not of representations or perceptions, but of contents. And that's where you find that word content. So we don't talk about aspects of the unconscious as perceptions necessarily, but of unconscious contents as I usually do, he says. Here I must anticipate a point with which I shall be dealing at some length later on, namely the fact that something very like representedness or consciousness does attach itself, namely the fact that something very like representedness or consciousness does attach to unconscious contents, so that the possibility of an unconscious subject becomes a serious question. So these guys are arguing, if you're going to take all this unconscious stuff seriously, then who is it, where is it, whose is it, locate it, measure it. You can't do any of that. They're saying it's all bets are off when that starts to happen. And Jung says, no, actually, I don't think so. Because consciousness does attach to unconscious contents. So what does that mean? Consciousness does attach to unconscious contents. Brief, probably not the best example, but just the idea that I can have a dream about real stuff, right? There's my dad, there's my mom, there's the house where we grew up, right? Familiar objects from consciousness, right? Things of the conscious mind, of the conscious experience, attaching themselves to unconscious contents. Why is my mother dressed as, you know, Mary, Jesus' mother? I don't know, I'm making this up. But you see what I'm saying? Things in the dream life maneuver that way. The personal meshes with the non-personal. The things of conscious content, the things of conscious waking experience begin to merge and meld and attach themselves to the things of the unconscious, to the contents of the unconscious. And of course, you guys all know the difference between what Jung called the big dream and the little dream, which of course he gets from Native American culture and so on. The little dream is the ordinary dream, the one where mom, dad, and the family dog show up. And the big dream is the dream where you're face to face with some extraordinary being that has no bearing on any of your waking conscious reality. Those are the big dreams, the archetypal dreams. And of course, there are dreams where the two are mixed, the personal levels, the archetypal levels, and all dreams can be looked at from each level, from all of those levels. But he says it's just that fact that the things of consciousness do attach themselves to the unconscious, that, and when you look at this over and over and over, over 20, 30, 50 years of life, and you start to see how your dreams speak to you, that the possibility of an unconscious subject becomes a serious question. Because the ego doesn't shape these. Waking life, the dream life is so extensive that all the conscious experiences can't create that. You couldn't create that with intention if you had to. And that's where, you hear where he's going here. He's talking about the self. Did you hear that? That's where he was headed? Sort of? You with me? John's with me. John's nodding. Yeah? Charles is nodding. Okay. So the possibility of an unconscious subject becomes a serious question. That's, of course, the self. There is, nevertheless, an inborn pattern of behavior, and just such a treasure house, not indeed of anticipated, but of accumulated life experiences. Only it is not a question of representation, but of sketches, plans, or images, which, though not actually presented to the ego by consciousness, are yet just as real as Kant's 100 thalers, which had been sewn into the lining of a jacket. A thaler is a silver coin. So in other words, the wearer of the coat may not know it, but he's actually got silver coins hidden in the lining of his jacket. And he's saying that's the value of the archetype. You may not know it walking through conscious life, but as you walk through conscious life, those coins, those experiences, the shapings of an archetype work on you, just as the unconscious provides conversation with the stuff of conscious life as well. They're mutually shaping one another all the time. So the archetypes are not just theoretical ideas. They are the stuff of the personal life. They are the stuff of everyday waking reality, as well as stuff that appears in dreams. And then he credits Adolphe Bastien's elementary ideas as really the fundamental analogous forms of perception that he calls the archetypes. He says, it would be incorrect to assume that the rejection of the idea of the unconscious in academic psychology at the turn of the century was anything like universal. And then he credits Fechner and Lips. And he says, I mean, really, I think that's the most depressing statement in the whole essay. It would be incorrect to, it's just like he's just trying to be really optimistic. It would be incorrect to assume that the rejection of the idea of the unconscious in academic psychology at the turn of the century was anything like universal. It is so much more universal now than it was when he wrote this. And I think that's a sad state of affairs. But once again, he quotes Lips here. Observation of conscious life persuades us that not only are unconscious perceptions and representations at times to be found in us, but that psychic life proceeds in that form most of the time. And only occasionally, at special points, does the agent within us reveal its presence directly in appropriate images. Thus, psychic life always goes far beyond the bounds of what is or may be present in us in the form of conscious contents or images. Nevertheless, he says, resistance to the hypothesis of the unconscious persisted, past tense, persisted for a long time afterwards. And of course, it persists today. And that's it for me. Thoughts? Yes. I think universities are built on the structure of different disciplines. And, I think you're right that I think there are institutions that are getting it, you know, the existence of a place like Pacifica, Antioch. I'm teaching at Edinger at Antioch. I would be stoned at other universities for teaching Edinger. You know, they think it's great. There are pockets of it in the culture, and I that's definitely to be held on to. But I think a lot of academia, and I'm pretty cynical about it personally. But I do think that there are, everything is run by people. And people have experiences. And generally speaking, academia is safer here because their job is to perpetuate the bodies of knowledge that have come prior. I had a philosophy professor who once said to me, when I used to get all psychological on him, he would say, if you want to practice philosophy, go grind glasses, which was Spinoza's profession. You know, in other words, if you want to be a philosopher, then go find something that will help you earn a living while you're writing your philosophy. Because academic philosophy, his point was the history of philosophy. You don't do philosophy as a philosophy professor. First, you have to teach all the Greeks for 25 years, and then you get to write your magnum opus, and maybe you have something to say. There's actually a line in this section of this essay where he, I believe he's quoting Fechner. And Fechner, another pretty fabulous psychologist who's just been sort of written out of the history of psychology, Fechner did a lot of work on perception. And, prior to, he wasn't a neurologist, I don't believe, but sort of in that threshold between neurology and psychology. And I think you're right that the physiological responses, I don't have to consciously think about my heartbeat. I mean, we know that the nervous system is so incredibly complex that emotion happens at the cellular level, you know, through molecules and all kinds of other things. And we know that there's just so much that we don't know that isn't mapped. And I hope that there are the enlightened, physiologists and neurologists out there in the world who are doing this kind of work, because it is so crucial. No politics. No. John? No. Yes, no. You see, when you're a Jungian, you get to do that. You get to go, well, on the one hand, but on the other hand. And then you're balanced, you see, and you can say you're a Jungian. The self is, Edinger, and I think he probably gets this directly from Jung, says that the self is both the center and the circumference of the psyche. So there you go.
Both the center and the circumference.
So both the organizing point and the totality. So you can probably say on some level that the self equals the psyche. On the other hand, there are so many anatomical components of the psyche, and I would recommend Edinger's book, The Anatomy of the Psyche, for those of you who are interested. He uses alchemy and uses the alchemical operations to show the various functions of the psyche quite well. You know, if walking and turning or standing or bending are anatomical functions of movement, or components of movement, Edinger does that for the psyche in that book through those alchemical operations. Because, if you say that the self is the psyche, then you leave out the relationship between self and ego. Well, as we go through life, this is the model that Edinger uses, the ego emerges out of the self, or maybe the self emerges out of the ego. So you get to play that way as well. But that's Edinger's model, and that it's this axis that's crucial. And when the axis is broken, you've got psychosis. And when you've got a healthy functioning axis, you have a person connected to what you might call a healthy religious impulse. So we're pretty off the subject at the moment, but what fun. Any other thoughts? Well, I think we're going to have, I'm going to ask for about 10 people to continue this class if you want to continue this essay. If not, that's fine too. But just to make it worthwhile as far as the discussion and so on. So talk to Diane if you want to continue. I'm happy to continue, and if not, that's fine too. But thank you very much for your participation. That makes all the difference, and thanks for being here.
And that is the end of the recording. This recording was made on DVD, and it included some images. The DVD is available in the library at the C.G. Jung Society, Seattle. The copyright is C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.